Hello and welcome to episode 4 of the Spring Podcast. We're still in lockdown, unfortunately, due to the global situation. But we're keeping ourselves busy. We just had the inaugural Gravel Crew virtual pub beer rally quiz pub beer thing last night, which was good old crack. So hopefully a few of you were able to join in that and have a bit of fun again. Just thanks to everyone for tuning in the last few weeks. It's been great to see the response and see that people are enjoying it. And as we said last week, we're just working on getting up on different platforms. When we have them up, when we have the episodes up, we'll let you know. So back again this week, we have Tommy.
Well, how's it going?
And William is here again this week.
Yeah, that's a record for me now, 2 weeks in a row.
I know, man. Jesus, fair play.
Go for that. Go for the hat trick next week.
Yeah. Have you had this put in now for a couple of weeks, or what's the crack?
Yeah, I booked in some private time myself now.
Okay. No, fair play. Yeah, yeah. What? You're not getting paid for this, you know that?
What?
Yeah. Look, we'll discuss this maybe later on.
He doesn't get out of bed for less than 10 bags of munchies a day.
Man, I had an attempt at a home haircut today. I know it's fairly bad. Thanks to the God, the podcast is an audio only medium. I don't think anyone needs to see it.
It's, do you look like something from the Amish country or something?
I know, man. It's long. It's party on top and just fucking skinhead everywhere else. So it's,
I think I'm going to resemble something like the Grunt out of the Dunbelievers videos. No, this is over.
Yeah.
Even more actually, so.
Apart from Moss wrecking his hair over the bank holiday weekend, what did you actually go up to? We should have been rallying, but obviously we can't.
Well, within a 2 kilometer radius, I've been doing lots of walking and listening to other podcasts. As we know, other podcasts are available, notably the Chris Harris one. I listened to the Chris Harris one with Nikki Grist and another one then with Chris Goodwin, another writer. But other than that, watching rally videos, playing Dirt Rally 2.0, looking back at old onboards I've done, checking my pace notes against them, rewriting pace notes.
You are such a professional.
I'm a very tolerant girlfriend, it has to be said.
On Tommy's point there, I'm waiting for it to arrive tomorrow, my PS4 and Dirt 2.
Good lads!
Which means, I know it's...
I thought you were going to say my PS2 and Colin McRae 4.
I finally have a PS4 and Dirt 2. So I know it sounds horrible, but I mean, lockdown could go down as far as December.
I'm treating lockdown very similar to... Like, it's funny that we're watching the 2001 WRC. Circa that time, I wasn't old enough to have a summer job because I think... 2001, I would have been 16, right? Could just about qualify to get a summer job, assuming someone would take you on.
You just couldn't be arsed.
No one felt brave enough to, you know, employ me. But this is very similar for some people who notice that, like, it's like you're being grounded, but, you know, you can stay at home and watch TV. You probably have to do a bit of gardening or, you know, help around the house a bit. But essentially, your sleeping patterns are gone awry. The whole thing kind of has gone out the window, you know.
Yeah. I suppose fortunate in a way, you know, it is tough on people, I suppose. But
it is tough.
Hopefully, look, we can give people a small bit of escapism for an hour or so a week, and, you know, it keeps us busy as well. So,
and you know what?
There's positives in everything, you know, and we have to look at the positives and try and help each other to help the bigger picture here, you know.
It gives you time to do the stuff that you wouldn't normally do. I mean, this weekend I managed to clear out my entire shed and paint the floor. I mean, I'd never do that, ever.
More in your mind to do a bit of work on the stuff that's in the shed.
No, don't be crazy, Tommy. Just that'd be ridiculous. Don't.
There's nothing in there.
Yeah, we can't. He can't just totally change his, you know, life. At least the shed is good now.
But yeah. I actually have a shed, to be fair.
Yeah. But what was I going to say? Yeah. So look, we've been getting just a friend of ours, Kieran, was talking to him during the week. He was just commenting on the podcast, and we got into talking just about the parallels between, this might be a bit kind of far-fetched now, between like Serie A football in Italy in the 90s. And
is he likening us to James Richardson?
I was just going to say, yeah. I'm sure, look, a lot of fellas our age, especially guys that were, you know, I was crazy into football. And it was almost half and half between you know, cars and football at that point, obviously. I have
a jumper wrapped around my neck at the moment, just, you know, in case you're wondering. I'm sipping a cappuccino.
But, no, just, again, just talking about things that were big influences on us at the time. Obviously, the WRC, you know, the review program and all the other media we were consuming, and even the PlayStation game, which we actually haven't mentioned yet, but we'll get to maybe in another episode. You know, all these things had a big influence. And I just remember, you know, how exotic that Football Italia program, with, you know, the team tune and the go Lazio thing, you know.
Yeah.
I was just laughing. But
I actually only recorded, there was BT Sport did, BT Sport, it has to be said, yeah, they've gone streets ahead of Sky or any of their counterparts in terms of their output. They do these things, these films, and there's a lot of content on it that you might not be interested in, but they've done it in such a way that it makes it interesting. And they did one on Gazzetto Football Italia, and basically how unique it was at the time on Channel 4. But an interesting person popped up in it, because it was a guy named Neil Duncanson of Chrysalis Sport. But Chrysalis Sport evolved to become North One. And Neil Duncanson was part of the team behind WRC TV, I think, around the time looking at it now.
After kind of, was it another couple of seasons following?
No, it was in around the, because I do remember seeing his name mentioned in Rally XS a couple of times.
Okay.
I'm open to be corrected on that, but I'm confident that he overlapped in around this era.
Okay.
It could have been around the Channel 4 input as well.
Yeah, another like, it just, as I said, talking to Kieran, there used to be a shop in Cork, notices before I was living down here, and I never actually got to see it, but it was Football Crazy, I think it was called, and they used to sell like loads of, you know, the international jerseys and stuff. And then at the time in Cork as well, you had Pit Lane, which was like a dedicated shop, and like I was like a mini David Lapworth going around the place there for a few years with the Subaru here, like with the freaking fleece, the jacket, the cap, the whole lot, like. And you know, I just remember going to, I'm pretty sure I wore a fleece or something to a teenage disco once, just to you know, really make sure.
Any Watford, anyone who frequented Watford IT in the mid 2000s, and they're wondering who it was that was in around the nightclubs wearing the Subaru World Rally team shirt. That was me.
Just in case any potential partner, you know, just to be sure and turn them out. Yeah. Totally, like,
but, yeah.
I actually still have all the gear. I obviously not wearing it now, but it still
feels. It feels better now than it did then.
Yeah. On that point, actually, we should definitely do a piece on that at some stage, because we've been talking about this a lot before, but all the obscure old school gear that we still have hanging up.
I have some
questionable stuff that's just damn cool. Like,
I went through a phase there. Every bit of merchandise I brought for I bought for a particular team, the team went to ground not long after. So Subaru obviously pulled out, Suzuki, Bosian, I had a Bosian racing fleece there. I'm pretty
What's
sure.
What's your most obscure item?
A Renault Formula E jacket. I can't even remember where I picked it up, but I've never worn it while driving the Renaults. So, you know, I haven't, if that ever happens, I just have to give up.
If you cross that line, Master's not coming back.
No,
I think
it's yours, Will.
I'd say it's probably a cross between the Suzuki SX4 Yellow Jacket. I actually bought at Rally Spain in 2010 because it was cheap and that's all I could afford. I'd say either that or I had. Do you know, just the simple cheap t-shirts, just a normal polo t-shirt, not even polo t-shirt, just a, what do they call them? Plain t-shirt, a Peugeot 307 WRC one.
Of what?
Yeah. Oh, God.
Free Willy.
No, I'm pretty sure I bought that at the
whale itself.
I remember in my poor teenage years going over to the trucks outside the Glen Eagle and going, what can I afford to buy?
I remember that.
I had a good selection of woolly hats, and unfortunately they go through rotations of use, and then they'd end up at home with, you know, on the farm, and then the old fella would get them on the farm, and, you know, they'd be used as rags eventually. I think I actually was clearing out a shed at home there not so long ago. I found a Peugeot Sport hat, and I tried to rescue it, but I'd say no, she's probably gone beyond use at this stage for sure.
I just noticed in the corner of the room here there's actually a CD holder, you know, like a CD zip holder, a Subaru World Rally Team one.
I still have the old 90s Subaru baseball caps. And it was the old blue colour.
Yeah.
Because again, I think I have about 4,000 woolly hats.
Yeah. I can't throw any of it away either.
I won't do it.
Whatever misplaced nostalgia. Or maybe I think that they'd be cool to have in the future. But even most of them pretty much are retro at this
point. But a lot of them, you could even say, this is going to be a British statement, a lot of them have stood the test of time in terms of style. They've actually aged quite well.
Jeez, that is a big statement, Tommy.
It's a big statement. But when you look at the stuff that's there now, it's aged quite well. And, like, I mean, we don't, like, you go to a rally nowadays and it's very hard to find something that you say, yeah, I want that. It doesn't seem to have the wow attraction, but it could be because it's attached to the era too. And it's
very proud of my rally art jacket, the one I got at the Classic Car Show.
I've seen one on eBay. My eye is on one.
I was looking for one, I'd say, for about nearly 10 years. I was trying to find a good one, good, proper, original quality one. And this shop at the Classic Car Show, stroll up, and your man had three brand new ones wrapped up.
Very good.
Bear in mind, they come over on a Ryanair flight with absolutely nothing I'll ever bring back with me. But
you were like an onion going home with the ears on you.
It's a big job strapping in an airline seatbelt with a big jacket on.
Yeah. But anyway, right. that's just a small tangent there. But shout out to Kieran anyway again and his brother who are the listeners of the podcast. So thanks for reminding us of that era again. Like you just draws.
Pepe Sonoria likes this.
It just shows how I suppose fascinating anything kind of European. If you want to compare it, like, you know, in terms of football, we'd League of Ireland versus Serie A. This is like we'd the Stone Throwers versus the head of San Remo. Do you know, it's so different and exotic and stuff like that. But anyway, sure, we'll move on to the events for Catalonia this week. Significant event for a number of reasons. It was still based in Lloret de Mar. At this point, they hadn't moved to Salou yet, even though some of the stages were, I think the Sahara stages were up, like the likes of Pratdip and stuff like that. I think they were near Tarragona. When was it? 2005, I think they moved on to Salou. But that meant that, you know, there was a fair chunk of road miles there because the base, Lloret de Mar, was the north of Barcelona, we'll say, up the coast. They travelled, you know, down below Barcelona then for the Saturday and back up again for the Sunday. So, you know, there was a couple of different service areas and stuff like that. But it's just, you know, just they've been obviously doing that for a while. Pratdip is a well-known, and Escalade was a well-known stage as well from Catalonia's past. The big, I suppose, news entry-wise was the debut of the Zara WRCs in a World Championship arena. So they had Jesus Porras and Filip Bogalski in the two cars. So before they even kicked off, Porras was in a spot of bother because apparently he'd been using notes from regional rallies based around the area from his old Spanish Championship days and things like that. There's one whatever it was about Burris, there always seemed to be a little bit of controversy following him around. Whatever it was, and he was a very quick driver, but I don't know. There was always a sideshow to what was going on that seemed to be hanging over him.
But that question that arose over Purez using notes, I mean, if you look nowadays, 90% of the world rallies, I think they all seem to reuse routes from the year before. So I think what you find is a lot of the crews nowadays, they're refining their notes year on year. So I'd have a little bit of sympathy for him in that, you know. But the other side of the coin is, if he was caught out on the stage and he wasn't meant to be out on the stages, that's a different story.
Yeah, like it's obviously, you know, it's almost like taboo in some cases. You know, you'd always hear stories here and there of people being caught on stages and whatever. And I remember Jesus is talking to Munster passed down the bottom of our road a few years back, and we competed in it, but you're like, you had to go to work, you had to go to college. You know, we couldn't help but be on the road. Like, but it's just, I suppose, at a world level, you know, it's obviously pretty serious.
But I think, Morris, at that point for Porras, like, I had no interest in the arguments they had over his notes, because, like Tommy said, if you're doing events year on year in WRC, you're revising them year on year. If he's done national events, even if he did use pace notes, like I'll make the point about Oriel squinging through the event. I just think it's baseless to them. Like you said, if you live in the area, you know the roads, you're gonna know them. Oh shit! Like
we've gone to Killarney year on year, and the notes, they get refined. There is an argument for that. If there's a mistake in the notes the year before, there's a strong risk that you carry the mistake over, but really you're looking out to see if you're going to be improving the notes. There's bits you'll be taking out, there'll be bits you'll be making quicker. You probably should be making a fresh set, but it all depends on the driver. If his is Purez had a set of notes when he won a national rally within that region, that the maps correspond to be the same stage, you know, who are you to blame him for using them, you know?
Yeah, I suppose, it's 20 years ago now, we're not going to get too hung up on it now, but it's just interesting to know the amount of talk there was at the time. Maybe, I guess...
Jesus is getting an awful amount of discussion, you know, on an Easter weekend, isn't it?
That's a good point, actually. Yeah,
we're
recording this on Easter Monday, and of course it's kind of fitting in a way, but I guess it kind of shows as well, like, how much you know, stage Citroën was being held in. Even though this is our first, you know, world championship event with the car, there was already a fair bit of I suppose fear in the through the service park that they were going to be on the pace pretty much straight away. And you know, teams aren't stupid. And even though information mightn't have been as readily available back then, they would have been watching what was going on with the development of the car and seeing how it went in the French Championship. And it's a funny one, because like Peugeot came back into the sport, the top level of the sport, in 99 with the 206, obviously. That thing was quick, straight out of the box. Peugeot don't have a history of doing things by halves. They generally tend to come in and do it right whenever they go in, whatever avenue of the sport they go into. So Citroën, they had a prototype World Rally car running in 99. There's pictures somewhere on the internet, I'm sure, the gravel crew.
The T4.
In a white livery with the pre-facelift lights, we'll say. And there was talks at the time that they weren't actually going to go ahead with the program for some reason. I'm not sure what it was. I think it was in one of Martin Holmes' rally sports, or the, what you call it, the Pirelli yearbooks or whatever, that they said that they didn't think they were going to go ahead with it. Then in 2000, they ran the car in the French Championship with a kind of a national homologation. I'm not really sure the finer points of it, but it was obviously, you know, I think Bogalski won pretty much every round, from what I recall. French Championship was all, the main championship was like Ireland, it was all tarmac. And you know, would have been, the pace would have been pretty hot there. So obviously Bogalski was a very talented driver as well. He'd won Corsica and Catalonia 99 in the kick cap, and he had good results going back along in various other cars and stuff. But so coming into 2001 into Catalonia, I'd say people were definitely taking him seriously. Like, and even though they weren't doing the full season and they weren't going to be any threat in terms of you know, the overall championship, the drivers and the manufacturers, there was definitely a bit of apprehension about where things were going to go, and they were dead right to be afraid, as the following years would prove, you know. And you can even see it, like, in any the footage of the car throughout the event, and from the stage time straight away, man, the thing was so quick on tarmac straight away. It just looked, and it looked like it was, you know, handling different to every other car. Even
it looked planted everywhere.
So planted. It was like a little touring car.
Yeah.
And it wasn't sliding, you know, there was no drama. It was just
of the 17 stages that ran, Citroën were quickest on 10.
That's fair going for the first event for the new car. Like, and you know, it was the reliability was to catch him. It was a couple of small issues, like, but you know, you can make a quick car reliable, but it's very hard to make a reliable car quicker. You know, when they come in, so I think they had the fundamentals of it right. Yeah, we'll get to that as we walk through the event. Just looking at the other notable bits for the Works teams, Tommy was very happy with the Evo. He commented in the build up that the work to the rear suspension was making the car a lot easier to drive. So obviously, Rally Arts efforts with, you know, putting major work into the Group A car were working for him. It's interesting to note as well, as was going into the event and looking at how Ford and Subaru were to get on. McRae had actually won in 2000 in the Focus on Michelins, and Burns was second, and he was less than 6 seconds behind him in the end on Pirellis. And you look at how much it changed in a year, and like, the Fords were nowhere for a lot of the rally, like, nowhere.
Yeah.
It was a problem that dogged the Focus until they brought in the 0-3 car. It was very hard to get it, you know, up to speed, whether it was the car itself. I think, and Killian, another friend of ours, Killian, has mentioned it. We said we'd try and figure it out, what was actually causing the Focus to be so off the pace from 2001 on. And it's a combination of the tires, the weight distribution wasn't fantastic, and
if you ever look at some of the corners, it always appeared to almost cock an inside rear wheel on some of the corners, despite the fact that it was a fairly long wheelbase car.
It was
commented on before that the problem they had with setting up that particular one for Irish tarmac was they used to have problems with the rear of the car. That was apparently...
That was one of the main design changes when they went to the 03. I don't know, there's, again, you could probably... You could spend a lot of time talking about that. It'd be nice to get someone on who was a lot closer to that car. And I think, even actually, I'll make the point now about on the opening shots of the event, I noticed there when I was watching it the other night, you can see one of our own, Tom Gahan, who'd be...
Well.
You can see... I noticed it when he's pulling into the service and they're doing the interviews, you can see Tom Gahan there jacking up the front of the car. And if anyone knows Irish Rallying, you know, Tom Gahan would be one of the top preparation lads here, very connected with Entwart and those cars. So it'd be cool to talk to him or one of those lads.
Yeah, so if anyone has the full story on why exactly the car was so off the pace, maybe you know, Peugeot and Citroën were obviously making great strides on tire at that point. You know, maybe it was just the pace of development.
Another school of thought is that the money that was being pumped in by Ford was not probably at the same level as what was being put in by the PSA group. The publicity that they were getting purely by having McRae in science, it was something that was alluded to in another podcast, was that the car was grand. It was okay, but it was starting to get left behind already. Like,
which is crazy, because if you think about it, that was a brand new car, brand new design in 1999. And so it was kind of, do you remember the way it was launched? It was the next level, the next technological advancements. Yeah. And it just never really lived up. Like, you'd wonder if they just seemed to spend all the money on paying McRae and Sainz.
McRae was the third highest paid sportsman in the United Kingdom.
And
Sainz
the highest paid.
Yeah, it's just all interesting points. But I suppose, as you mentioned, as we said, Peugeot, the PSA group, when they kind of put their mind to do something properly, they generally tend to achieve it. That's, you know, look back at the Group E days with the 205 and Le Mans, then with the 905 and things like that. With F1 was kind of the exception. The whatever.
But,
the,
Ford could be blamed the same way too. Like, you know, Ford went to F1 with Jaguar, and we all saw what happened there as well. So there is form in cutting the corners there, yeah. Perhaps.
Yeah, it's an interesting point. Again, it is that the focus was into its third year now. And like McRae was fairly fed up now with this, as we'll see. I don't think he even got that far. I think he had a fuel failure with the fuel pump on the first day, and he was asked after that. Do you know, what's the story? Are you reconsidering your future with Ford? And he says, look, the pace is there. We're just not getting to the end. And you know, I'd say he was getting fairly fed up. As we see as the season goes on, he obviously turned things around. You know. But it's just weird to see how it went. And I think this came up in the quiz. I don't know, we didn't really talk about it too much. It'd be interesting to see. I wonder how McRae would have got on if he'd stuck with Subaru for those 3 years, you know, with the 99 car was an improvement over the 98 car. The Peterhausen was obviously probably one of the best out there at the time. It would have just been funny to see what would have happened. But again, this is one of those questions.
You wonder, would it have suited his driving style with him, with how different those impressions became?
Yeah, it's another point. Actually, just on the Subaru point of view, Irish connection there with Boland's car, X7 SRT, that became Eamon Boland's car in 2002. Because I actually loved that car. I remember seeing
the baby blue coloured car.
Yeah, it was a really, really, really cool little car. Boland always had very decent machinery. I was pretty much as good as you could get back in the day. Anything else to note in the works teams? Liatti came in for Hyundai, obviously a tarmac specialist. Granholm was not nominated for manufacturer points this time. And he actually got off to a great start. He was actually the quickest loser for a while until he went off. But anyway, the other thing as well, which is interesting to note, and again, it's you know, kind of a strange parallel to what's happening now. The foot and mouth disease was obviously prevalent back then, probably not as much on the continent as in the UK and over here or whatever, but although we got away with it, to be fair, due to the efforts put in. But there was actually supposed to be spectator restrictions because of the foot and mouth, but like if you look at any of the onboards, and you know, even the drivers are complaining about it, that there was a lot of spectators around. And in silly places, and like as you said numerous times, from our own experience of spectating in European rallies, like the spectator control is pretty sketchy in places.
Saying that, in 2010 when I was there, it's obviously I was at Spain and Germany, but I thought Spain was unbelievably well managed when I was there. That's 10 years ago now.
Yeah, we were there. We were Catalonia in 2017, and I was just look. Maybe I'm just being in Monte Carlo last year. Monte Carlo was a real eye opener. That was really dodgy in places. I was really surprised.
It's the Latin temperament, maybe, you know. It's just...
Yeah, and there is a huge following over that. Obviously, Sainz was the big boy at the time. You know, Spain's highest paid sportsman. He was, you know, and Alonso was yet to come on the scene in a big way in the F1. Side of things, so I'd say he probably was their premier motorsport icon, I suppose.
There was 74 entries for the rally. Of those 74, there was 28 in the Class 8 class, World Rally Cars and Latter Day Group A. 17 of these were works entries. We also saw the appearance of the departed Seats, but they brought two of them out for this rally with Salvador Caneas and Mark Blasquez. And in the privateer entry, some notable privateers, Simon Joan Joseph, former Subaru and Ford works driver. Lewis Clement was actually out in a Corolla World Rally car following his departure from Skoda the year before. Portuguese seal surface specialist and gravel specialist Adrasilio Lopez, normally great guy to go in a 306 Maxi before opening a 206 World Car, Chris Princeton in the Bastos 206, and Yana Tuohino made an appearance as well. There was only two cars in Class A7, but there was 23 cars in Class A6, which I believe you're going to touch upon, Morris.
Yeah, that was the debut round for the what became the JWRC, the Junior World Rally Championship. Super 1600 was a new category back then, and it's just funny to see, you know, going back 2 years prior to this rally, an A7 car had won the event, the Zara Kick car, and, you know, going back before that, you had the 306 Maxis and the Megane Maxis and things, you know, they were kind of the some of the most significant cars of the late 90s, but obviously the cost, it was similar to the Super Touring regulations, the cost had just gotten out of control and they basically just priced themselves out of existence. So the idea with the Super 1600 cars was to, I suppose, provide a bit of a level playing field for the up and coming talent. I think the budget cap or the cost cap in the car was like €100,000, and there was limitations on the materials they could use, but they were still, as anyone who's seen a Super 1600 car go or been in one, they're still a serious bit of kit.
Like one of those, probably one of my favorite cars up until recent times was the Puma 1600, Super 1600 Puma, which Duval was out in that time, wasn't it?
Duval was out. There was a serious. If you look at the names, there's some.
Obviously, what a talent pool.
Yeah, really, really, really good, and guys that were to go on to have, you know, aside from the guy who was to win, but even the guys behind them, you know, their names you would have seen crop up in various rallies for years to come. So, and you know, it looked to be pretty competitive. So I think the aim, they were achieving their aim at the start anyway. But like anything, Super 1600 ended up kind of costing itself almost out of existence as well.
Like, what I liked about was the fact that you actually had a choice of product, which you don't seem to anymore if you go for any of these junior championships. Like, there was four manufacturers there to supply you, and there were other Super 1600s available that just didn't turn up actually on this event as well.
Yeah. I just love the way they have this financial cap on cars, and they still do it now. They still do a blatant lie of cost cap on cars.
Yeah.
You to talk to anyone who's either, you'd hear people talk, I heard Brian Champlin talking about it on Absolute Rally about the real costs and the real figures above what they claim to call as these cost-effective measures in motorsport. They're mutually exclusive. Cost-effectiveness and motorsport don't exist together.
Regarding the change from the S1000 rigs to the R5 rigs, and yeah, on paper, a part might be cheaper. Just, I don't know, take a wheel bearing as an example maybe. Yeah, sure, the unit cost for a single part might be cheaper, but if you're changing them out 10 times as often, it doesn't really stack up. But I guess, you know, they had to do something, and look, to be fair, it was a good initiative. It did require major support from I suppose the ASNs of each country to kind of prop up their young guys, and that's where France, you know, at that time and still to this day obviously excelled in terms of young driver support, as we were to see. But no, it was cool to see the different brands out there, and they were quick cars. I mean, 220-230 horsepower out of 1.6. That's pretty important.
Still some of the most exciting sounds you can ever hear on a stage now.
They're great. Like, and the cars look good as well. They kind of follow the kick car kind of template of, you know, big arches and, you know,
max power.
Yeah.
It was the perfect, it fitted the era really.
they sounded great, and it's always a treat, you know, to still see one, I think. But then you hear some of the rebuild costs for the engines. I think it was a Sedemo or Coupesal. I think Sedemo did the Clio engines.
Yeah.
And you're talking, you know, thousands and thousands and thousands for rebuilds alone.
Yeah, but that's just mental, because that's why the point about the cost caps, it just, like, I think especially looking at it from an engineer's point of view, looking at the way those parts are lifed, the way the materials are spec'd, they're built for what you call level one maintenance, and it's pointless, but it's so worth it because they're so cool.
There's probably somebody out there who'll be able to provide us with a little bit more detail on this, but the Puma, beautiful looking car, looked stunning. The uprights apparently were meant to be a known part that had a more limited mileage on them than others, but they also, there's, it was something to do with either the tread pitch on some of the bolts that, or the there was a particular pattern that they used that if you didn't have the right tools with you to change it, was a nightmare. Now, somebody out there definitely knows exactly what I'm talking about, because I've definitely heard it somewhere.
I've heard horror stories about the Puma, but bolts that you could nearly weld, you know, during service, and they'd come back in for, after the next loop, loose again, and shocks busting on trailers and all this, you know, not the most, I suppose, easy thing to run, but I suppose, you know, the idea at the time was good, and it was to prove, you know, it was to, the aim was to kind of get drivers, young drivers, in view of the big teams, and it was to work out. I think Loeb even made the comment during the rally that he, hopefully a big factory would take him on.
They
were still thinking about it. We'll get to that as we look through the rally. So yeah, so day one, looking at the times, and I suppose the fears that the teams had regarding the Citroën space was coming through straight away. They were flying immediately. So by the looks of it, Bogalski had brake issues for the first couple of stages, but Porras went into the lead immediately. You know, and that's despite not having the best raw position. I know it sounds silly to say in a tarmac event, but the amount of cuts in Catalonia, like the amount of gravel that's pulled onto the road is crazy. Like, it's, again, something that's to take note of if you've ever spectated there in person. Like, it's just, the TV doesn't really convey it. And they're beautiful stages. It's almost a bit like New Zealand on tarmac. There's a lovely flow at them, and a lot of cambered corners and mixture of kind of quick and, you know, and lovely smooth surface and stuff. But after three or four cars, half the ditches on the road, like, and they take serious cuts. I mean, we were standing at one spot in 2017, a quick corner, probably 5th or 6th gear, and we were standing the opposite side of the road, obviously, and the entry to the corner, you know, well back from where they were actually hitting the road, but we could actually feel the floor of every car that was hitting the edge of the tarmac, you know, as they were just throwing the car into the cut. You hear this. Feet, you actually feel it up to your feet, it's bang, like, so I can only imagine what that was like for the
1.2 ton at 90 mile an hour bang off the surface.
It's not just small gravel as well, like, it's like you see there, the size of the stones that could pull it out. Like, you walk down the stage after a run and you're looking at it going, sweet Christ,
yeah.
But they're doing two passes at these stages, so, like, you know, first on the road, while it's an advantage the first time, it's rendered useless the second time because you've had everyone.
And especially, you have lads driving with tactics, like, a lot of times. I know Lowell was very good at doing it, about really dirtying the road behind them. Like, they'd be cutting not just for time, but they're cutting to throw as much out as possible.
Yeah.
You see it if you watch Lowell's onboards over the years, the way he cuts corners, and the way you'd almost see him twitch in the car on purpose to knock as much out.
Yeah, it's kind of a dirty tactic if you want to. Could you look at it that way?
But it's like playing Mario Kart, you know?
Love, yeah.
Winning is winning.
But so as I said, the Citroën's off to a flying start. Burns had issues with his gearbox pretty much straight away as well. Mm. Yeah, something similar to in Portugal, but it actually caused him to spin at one point because it was not selecting gears. And
you see the other side of Burns as well, when Burns loses his cool. Same thing. Like, his
lap in Sweden too.
Like, he had the shovel, he'd given out to the spectators in Sweden, and then you can hear him really getting pissed off at Robert Reed. I think he's trying to get Robert Reed to...
Those gingers are known for it, though, you know.
But he's trying to get Reed to turn off the diff locks, and he's trying to keep it in gear and turn off all the diff locks, and he's shouting the hell off Robert Reed.
Yeah. I know, that's what he needs in the moment, yeah, but this is... the very top level of sport. This is a thing with a stupid problem with the car that's costing him his, you know, major.
But you look at that. You've hit the nail on the head there, Mars. It's the top level of the sport. I mean, the very best demand the best from those around them. The likes of Zinedine Zidane playing for Juventus, he demand the best. In motorsport context, Senna would demand the best of McLaren and his engineers. You know, so
yeah.
It goes with the territory.
And the other side of it as well is, you know, when you see a guy at world level dragging you walk back to service on three wheels or two wheels or whatever the case may be, and leaving absolute carnage behind him, it's understandable because, you know, this is professional top level sport. They're being paid a fortune to try and do this, and they obviously have to do the best they can and, you know, get the best result they can. Whereas if we see someone coming down the road in a local rally tearing the tarmac up or something, you'd be like, you just pull the fucking thing over and just stop, will you? But I know, look, it's just that's the way those guys were. They were obviously fairly fired up. Mackinnon was going well. Mackinnon actually was quickest in stage two. You know, and a fair bit quicker as well. He was, you know, obviously the margins in tarmac, they're pretty tight. But you know, good performance there from the car. Obviously, still had some bit of pace in it. He was nearly 4 seconds quicker than Poros in stage two. And Granholm was third. Granholm was, as we said there, he was the quickest of the futures there for a while, which is, you know, really impressive for a guy. You know, Scandinavians, you know, generally weren't the best, the most at home on tarmac, but he was beaten, you know, Ariel and Vinizzi for a time, which is some going, you know, two guys that were literally raised on tarmac. So fair play to him. He was always, and he did, Joe, you know, even though the results mightn't have been there through his career, he always did show flashes on tarmac. So a great pilot, and a guy would probably we might even do an individual podcast on Granholm in time to come. But Good spin out of him there in the morning.
Likes as well. The Likes Mitsubishi well, is yeah, showing yeah. very well.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then you had, well, how early on was, just going back to Subaru, there another wobble start with Solberg going off?
Yeah, Solberg must have been on borrowed time at that stage.
Well, do you know what I like about that though? And it goes to Lapwirt's comments about it, and he could show the difference in mentality from team management for younger drivers back then. Like, Solberg coming in under pressure with Burns back, Joe starting badly. Solberg's obviously young and experienced, going flat out, Grant, I'll try and get a result, and bang, goes off. Nowadays, you'll hear, obviously, we all know the history of me considering and manufacturers blaming drivers left, right, and centre, but like, it's nice to see Lapworth make the comments about Solberg saying, like, look, nah, it's not a time to kind of eat the head off him. We'll talk about the channel. We need to improve him.
I think there was history with Subaru there as well. Obviously, they'd seen, you know, Solberg was definitely from the McRae school of thought. I think, you know, he was the same kind of approach.
Yeah.
They'd been through that with Colin years previously. They'd obviously, you know, they knew the pace was there. It just took a bit of, I suppose, tutoring to get him to turn into the complete package. Solberg did as well, you know, credit to him. But as you said, to be fair to Lapwirt, he didn't eat the head off him on the coverage or anything like that. It was just a case of, look, this isn't the time for the big stick. We'll have a chat with him. And
exactly. Yeah. See, I think M-Sort are very good at that over the years as well.
You know yourself.
Drivers like time to actually develop.
You have to encourage people as well. You know, yeah. It's about kind of fostering an environment where, you know, someone can, you know, they're not driving with fear, you know, kind of it's to encourage them to go out there and do their best, you know, like, you know.
It takes time.
Yeah.
That's a good point you made about Meek as well. You know, Meek's career was, you know, a series of highs and lows. And, you know, when the lows came, they were very low. You know, it obviously.
But the highs were awesome.
The highs were awesome. Yeah, but that's a good example of a guy who was, you know, the pressure was probably put on him too much. Look, we could go back and forward about that all day. There's a lot of discussion to be had about that in the future as well, but we'll keep going on this. It's just interesting to note as well, you know, you could visibly see the Ford, the lack of grip they were having. I think Sainz was having issues in understeer. Delacour was the quickest of the Fords at one point. He was the first in that Michelin, or back in seventh, I think, by the end of the day or something. You know, Delacour.
Yeah, they were all Michelins. Actually, seventh was privateer, like we touched on earlier, Salvador Pineas in the SEAT. And yeah, Delacour, Sainz, and Marco Martin finished out the top 10.
Yeah, and Delacour, like, you know, a very, very talented guy in tarmac. The previous year, when he was in the Peugeot, he was fighting for wins in Corsica and San Remo and stuff. And then to be back this far, but you could see it, like the focus. There's one junction and Sainz is trying to get stopped for it and trying to get the oak straight. It's a kind of an open hairpin right, and the car is just all over the place. Like, I could say, I reckon the Pirellis probably had a lot to do with it. But then again, that just added to the excitement of it. The Pirellis were stronger in certain conditions than others, especially in the weight and stuff like that. But the Škodas weren't doing too bad, all things considered. I think Bruno Thierry was up to 10th at one point. So, you know, beating a couple of the works forwards and things like that on certain stages and beating the Hyundai. So not a bad performance, to be fair. Schwartz was having steering issues for a lot of the event, which was to put him out, I think, towards later on the rally. The steering just totally locked up with him and he couldn't go any further. But
of all cars to have steering lock up on.
Yeah. Holy shit. Oh, good. The poor Octavia.
He'd be like Armin Schwarzenegger at the end of it.
Yeah.
Really
good. Patent pending.
Yeah, you're here all week.
as we said already, McRae was gone out, just stayed with the fuel pump issue. Very, very frustrating event for him again. So this is four rallies down and no result. I think he Sweden was the only one he'd finished. And even then, that was out of the points because of both his own issues and issues with the car. So, a really, really bad start to the season. Granholm then as well was done out of this set as well. He pulled the wheel off and just got caught out. And again, the gravel being pulled out by people. Small error on the second right-hand corner. And car just went from him and pulled the back wheel off. And that was it. No super rally back then as well, of course. So, that was his weekend over. In terms of championship defences, one of the worst we'd probably seen at that point. But anyway,
Leicester City stuff.
Then actually on the whole point of what we mentioned at the start, the whole thing with the notes. One thing that frustrated me, and I know like a fan of Mazzel, double world champion, did ARL, but my God, I got exhausted listening to him. And on day one, he made the comment in one of the regroups where he said, Yeah, it's good to see the guys. Bogalski's good, fast. Poras isn't first, but we know why. Obviously, given out about the notes. So he claimed that Bogalski was ahead of him in second because the car was good, but Poras was in first because he was using illegal notes. So I'd love to understand his logic as to how two systems can be ahead of him, but one's cheating.
Burns was kind of withheld judgment. He just...
Until day three, he was like, yeah, there's the black cloud, but I'm not in the battle, so I don't care.
Yeah, he just kind of said, didn't really commit to saying anything, you know?
Yeah, it's just every single interview, Ariel's there going, oh, well, yeah, lads are cheating. I'm just shut up, Ariel, and just drive it.
Again, right, I can kind of see both sides of the argument here, in that this is the top level of the sport, and everyone is doing, you know, the best they can. Obviously, look, we're not going to say that everyone was abiding by all the rules all the time. You know, the regulations were being interpreted to the, you know, the their maximum, I guess you could say, or mightn't have been the you know, the most honest guy back in the day either. We don't know, right? But I suppose it was just frustrating to see, okay, this guy is leading. He does have this, I suppose, prior knowledge of the event. I don't know. It's hard to call it. Maybe there was a better relationship with Bogalski, the two guys being...
They would have been teammates at Lancia back in 92. Bogalski had a limited program in the Martini team.
Oh, yes, yeah, I remember that, actually, yeah. But, yeah.
I just think it's a baseless argument from Ariel.
I still reckon that a bit of the undercurrent of this was that they were wary of how quick the Citroens were. If Poros was quick, and you know, if he was in third or fourth place, I don't think there would have been as much murmuring. But the fact that the two cars were first and second,
I think the sore point as well was that, and it also crept in the F2 days, that they didn't like the idea of championship points being taken away from them. The fact that they're coming in, doing in a couple of events, and suddenly, you know, the maximum 10. It's taken by a guy we're not going to see again for the rest of the year in a car that we're not going to see until maybe the next tarmac rally. I think there might have been a sour taste in the mouth in general from that before.
Sorry, did Citroen register from this point on for the rest of the season?
I'd have to look at the standings. I don't think they showed in any of the official standings at the end of the year, so I'd say not.
So they weren't taking championship points. Yeah.
The drivers could, I think, though.
Yeah, that's a fair point, Tommy, actually. Like, you know, that they were able to focus their efforts on these selected events and put their maximum into them while everyone else had to worry about all the other events that were going on at the same time and whatever. So, but look, this is how they chose to introduce themselves into the sport. As we discussed, it was definitely the correct way. But I still think they were probably surprised by how quick the cars were.
People were a little embarrassed, to be honest, because there was a build up talking about all the development work that went into that Zara, and I think people are kind of like, yeah, look, it might be quick, but then they arrived, and I'd say people are kind of going, holy shit. Peugeot, especially, I'd say they were like,
Didier's bitter face just popped up on my screen there again, so yes.
Which kind of brings the point there on day one as well, with like Mäkinen holding his own on day one.
Mäkinen's performance, like in amongst, it would have been probably the least fancied of the cars to have been in there.
Mäkinen had no business being in the top four in that car, but what a drive.
Yeah, no, it was good going, and fair play to Freddie as well. He was too far away as well, so good stuff. So then going into day two. The Citroen started again where they'd left off. Bogalski had brake problems again, unfortunately. But Porras was going really well. He actually had a spin. I'm not sure was it on stage, the first or second stage, and lost a few seconds. But it was basically setting up to be kind of a battle between the two Citroens. And then Porras actually ran into issues later on the day with fuel pressure. Similar to what took McRae out, so that actually, you know, that was the end of all the accusations. Then he was out already, so it didn't really matter at that point. But it was kind of a shot across the bows for every other team as to how quick these guys were.
Did he make the comment during day two at some stage about the speculations were still going around? And he was like, "Yeah, look," he said, "I know the roads from doing rallies here years ago, and that's it."
Yeah,
so.
Like, hey, don't know. Look, we could probably.
I was going to say it, like, but it was a nice way to finish it. But then obviously he was gone, so.
Yeah, we could probably go around the circles about this now for the day.
That's the bone you have in your mouth now at the moment, and it is Aureal, isn't it?
I know why he's going on about Aureal so much and defending Aureal so much. It's because of those fucking sunglasses. It's
because he owns the sunglasses alone. Leave the sunglasses.
No. Fucking, I'm not here. I want to hear a good word about him. And he had a man in this event as well, of course, because it's sunny. And that's, I reckon that's where William is.
I can't support that. I'm the king of shit sunglasses. Yeah.
Look, it was nice to see Aureal going well. He'd had a poor enough year in 2000 in the Cordoba. He wasn't too far off Mäkinen in 99 for the championship. Obviously didn't get it, but
he must have been under pressure coming into this round though to deliver something, because the first three rounds had been quite disappointing from Aureal.
But he was kind of at the back end of the career anyway. I mean, it's like.
But he got a plum drive, you know, in a frontline car, you know, at a time in his career, like you said, William, when, you know, really should he have got one? And, like, he wasn't delivering, well, through circumstances, he hadn't delivered that in the first 3 months. There was probably an expectation on him to bring something.
We won't take it away from you. Like, he's still one of the legends of the sport. Fantastic driver.
Yeah.
But I just think I just always found that drive a bit strange.
As I said, it was unusual to see a guy fall into a seat like that. And I suppose Kankinen with Subaru would have been something sort of similar. Even, you know, and this isn't taking anything away from the guys, but they were, you know, heading towards the end of their careers. But Aureal, this is probably the peak of Aureal season. This event, I don't think he got on too well with the Peugeot ethos, obviously. It was heavily Scandinavian influence at the time with Granholm. He was the number one in the one certain terms. You had Rob and Pera coming on the scene then as well. And I don't think, like, Aureal, he was a very talented guy, but he was also extremely, precise with his setup. And he, you know, you hear stories about him nor he'd ask for his seat to be moved 2 millimeters back or up or whatever, I think it was when he was at Lancia or something, and they didn't bother doing it. They said, nah, he won't notice that. And he came back in roaring and shouting about why hadn't they moved the seat. So I just hear little small kind of snippets like that, and I'm not sure how well he would have gelled with the team. But as well, it's unusual to note his driving style. I don't think Ariel ever left for brakes. I don't think he ever got on top of the technique. Which was, you know, unusual at the time, because the cars were more or less fully active at this stage, the majority of them, and to get the most out of the distance stuff like that, left foot braking was becoming the especially on tire and things, that was the way to get the best out of them. And also the way he held the wheel, it's just kind of reminiscent of John Alesi, you know, the hands at 10-2 rather than 4-3. yeah, very kind of abrupt movements of the wheel. But, you know, it's just again, because the way driving styles went in years to follow, everyone kind of has to follow the same pattern almost. Back then, you could still see there was still a tolerance for slightly different styles. So it's just interesting to know that he was able to be on the pace despite having a pretty different approach to everyone else. But so Bogalski was leading by 27 seconds at the end of the day, which is a really good one. Brand new car, had no issues up to that point with it. Bogalski had obviously had experience of leading world championship events before. He'd won, as we mentioned, in 99. So I'd say it wasn't phasing him at all. He was just driving the way it was, and as we mentioned in looking at the coverage, the car was super quick looking, super tidy. It was, and you could see where the sport was heading for the next few years with the way that car was driving. Then we had Ariel. Pinizzi was 40 seconds. Pinizzi was having more enough event by his standards at the time.
I think that's a huge expected Pinizzi to be, and that's why obviously Grönholm not been nominated. I think they were expecting Pinizzi to come in and put manners on Citroën. And to be honest, I'd say a lot of people did, but I don't know where it came from. Was he having any issues with the car?
No,
that
doesn't appear to have been.
Were they just blitzed at the start, and maybe they were mentally beaten?
They nominated him for manufacturer points as well. Ariel had won Catalonia in 98 in the Corolla, so they'd obviously hedged their bets with these guys that they were going to bring home the goods. But yeah, for whatever reason, I don't know. And I suppose Pinizzi, like in the following year, he was pretty much untouchable. Even in San Remo with half shoulder. he was pretty shook up for that, and he still dominated. But just a strange one, very quick guy as well at the time, but for whatever reason, on this event, it wasn't quite clicking from when up to then. McAdam then was in fourth. Again, you know, fair play. It was fair going to drag that car up to fourth. And on this event, the tyres were obviously helping him some bit. There were dimensions and stuff, but no, it was at this point in the year, you would have fucking been a brave man to bet against the McAdam title. I'd say going by the way he was, even on events that didn't suit him the best, he was still going really well. So. It was good.
But for a Finn as well, like, you know, they're not reputed to like sealed surfaces as their favourite thing to compete on. Like, McKinnon's strike rate and, you know, his ability, you know, it hadn't been seen in quite a long time either. You know?
McKinnon won Catalonia before, didn't he?
He did, actually, yeah.
97, was it?
Yeah.
And he did in the Evo 4.
And he Sanremo, did. He won Sanremo in 90...
Against Pinizzi. It was a long stage. There's a really good footage on that.
The big accident?
In Catalonia?
Yeah, was it 2002?
95, he hit a lot of spectators' cars, I think.
No, do you remember the one where it's a narrow section there and there's a very, very low wall on the outside, and they come along and they just head straight in, head on into the cliff, and the car's left upside down?
That's later this year.
Yeah, it's Korska.
Korska, sorry. Yeah.
Spoiler
alert.
Yeah, spoiler alert. Again, ignore that last.
We can edit that bit out.
We won't, because we're not like that. We're extremely
While we're on the topic of Mitsubishi, we bring up that point there that I wanted to make about Andrew Cohen talking about the water-cooled calipers on the Evo.
Mm.
And I know, was this a common thing with most cars around that time? Or because I know I was only reading this on, there's actually a really good Twitter page. I think it's WRC Aero or something like that, where they do a lot of tech pieces on the 2017 cars. And they're talking about the change and all the complicated duct systems in the bodywork for cooling calipers and discs. And they were talking about why a lot of people moved away from that water cooler system, because purely from, like, if you're looking at it from a risk perspective, when you're looking at designing systems and engineering systems and all that kind of thing, you're looking at the points of failure and all that kind of stuff. I'd love to see how much work went into designing and running those systems on those cars. You know, like having a complicated water cooling system on a brake caliper.
The F2 cars had them even back in the mid to late 90s, because I remember seeing on RPM's footage of some of the events for the BRC crossed in with the Irish Tarmac ones, where reference was made to some of the cars running water-cooled brakes.
Yeah, I think there's maybe a shift in mindset with that stuff, in that, again, like if a system like that, if you all of a sudden had a failure in your water cooling system, your brakes starting to overheat because your ducting isn't designed around it to keep it cool. So you have a single point of failure, bang, brakes overheating, and you have trouble.
Yeah, it's an interesting point, actually. Yeah,
less is more.
Just that, like that. That's just engineering nerdy, porny stuff now for anyone who likes that. But if anyone wants to look at it, I know there is a Twitter page, WRC Aero.
There's another blog, actually, WRC Wings, that's similar. I think it's a couple of Finnish guys that are involved, and yeah, it's really good, actually. It's worth having a look at if you're into that kind of stuff. Takes you through, as you said, some of the aero developments, especially from, you know, this era onwards, where aero started to play a bigger and bigger part in the pace of the cars. Obviously not to the extent it does these days. The cars are basically DTM cars and gravel at this point, but that's a different story. And to the A3, Bogalski was quick over the blocks once again, but unfortunately ran into some issues with his clutch. I think it was starting to go at the end of the first stage in the morning. The stages were back up. I think they were using some of the same bits of road, maybe reversed as they did in day one. This time around, up around Lure at the Mare again. So the problem is
getting the stage, the call the Bracon or Bracones, whatever you call it.
Yeah, that's the one. It wasn't actually slowing him massively after a while, because he was able to drive. He just didn't have the clutch. For taking off, he was having to start there's one bit of footage, actually. He at the start of the stage, he's actually sitting New York on the limiter in neutral and just bangs into first.
Yes.
I love to see that. That's brilliant.
If you saw that, if saw a local guy doing that at home in an Escort or something, you'd nearly be, you know, taken to the doctor to get his head examined, like, but because these are the works guys, the works teams behind him, it's the level of competition or the level that they're at, they can get away with.
He's not having to go home to rip a gearbox out of a car on a Monday night.
No, he's not the one who has to go and try and rebuild that box after that. You can tell that.
Explain to the wife why they have to yet again go on no more holidays for the next 5 years.
Yeah,
he was unlucky. He was unlucky with that one, though, because he got caught. I think the car conked after the arrival control, between the arrival control and the start control, and he was running first on the road. But when he got going, when he was able to get the car going, he didn't start right on the start line.
That was it, yeah. He had the issue where he did that jump start because he was too far away from the line. But then the other one was didn't he conk it off the start line, and you have 20 seconds to clear the control?
No, I think it was. Yeah, I'm not sure whether it was the start control or whether it was the advanced start control.
No, it was because that rule is still there. That rule caught Solberg in 2006 as well in Sweden, whereby when you're off the start line, they have the arrival control start line, and then they have another kind of orange boards after that, and that's still the control zone. So if you don't clear the start line in 20 seconds, you're going to get a penalty for every minute you're over.
No, it's just from the television coverage, it's not clear what control he's in there. You see, that's the thing. That's what happened.
Because the reason I know is because that obscure rule that cuts Solberg in Sweden in 06. It's a mental rule. Like,
yeah, it's one of them kind of regulation things that just seem kind of silly, but I suppose they have to keep some bit of control on what's going on as well.
Yeah.
It was just a pity for the guy, you know, he'd driven superbly all event. The car was quick. He was in line for another win. And if you look at, he got penalised 2 minutes, I think, for the time or either arriving late or the time control issue, and then another 2 minutes as well for the
was he third or fourth before they gave the penalty for the jump start after the
fourth. Yeah, he would have been fourth, and he was down to eight. I think it was 4 minutes 10 or 20 was the total that they penalised him by. But if you subtract that from his actual, you know, stage time, he would have won the event comfortably. So, it was a promising, a very promising debut for the car in terms of pace, and it was going to prove a kind of an ominous, I suppose, signal for what way things were to pan out for the next few years for the sport.
Did anyone spot Auriel's brown trousers moment?
Yes. And
yeah, that was,
isn't that one of the best, it's one of those classic onboard pieces.
The rock face just coming.
Yeah, and he's there and switches to the camera down underneath the dash, and you can see Auriel's elbows nearly hitting the roof, going from lock to lock.
Yeah, it was kind of one of those, you know, it was caused by the cut. He seemed to drop both front wheels almost. He was that far into the cut, and obviously he just caught, might have caught the underside of the car on the edge of the tarmac, and just flicked him. And as you said, you know, maybe another couple of inches to the left, and he could have been out. He could have pulled the wheel off or whatever, but he got away with it anyway. He was lucky. Liatti went out as well. Really strange off. It just, the car, just whatever happened, I don't know whether it's an engine breakage or a brake issue or something.
Yeah, it looked slow. It looked, then all of us just, it looked like he was coming slow into it, and then all of a sudden the car just snapped.
Yeah.
Swapped ends.
Yeah, I don't know, maybe a brake issue, the rear locked up or transmission or suspension, something, it was as if something broke in the car. So it's really unusual for a car to just take off like that, but that was to be fair, look, pity Liatti's pace. You know, I don't think it was any fault of his. The car just wasn't at the races. You needed power for them kind of stages in the Hyundai, as we've mentioned already. Even with the second evolution, the engine wasn't the strongest. But looking at the rest of it, Burns was in gearbox trouble then again. And I think he actually hit the car very close to the end, ended up outside of the points. So another pretty disastrous event for Subaru. No cars in the top six by the end of it. So do you know
what? There was a serious battle for fourth between Sainz, Delacour and Burns. You know, Burns, like you said, he kind of took himself out of that battle with the damaged rim. But Sainz and Delacour, there was little or nothing between them throughout the rally.
Yeah, but I think, like, yeah, they were close, but it was a
very poor jump to start, though. He lost time.
Yeah, like, it was a poor rally for Sainz from day one. Like, it's like that's the best you can hope for, battling for fifth.
I wouldn't. Yeah, probably wasn't. Look, it wasn't his fault.
Just unlucky. But
yeah, the car just wasn't quick enough. It's a pity. It didn't. He drove the way he kind of always drove in this era. There was very few mistakes from him. He was always thereabouts and just bringing home the points. And, you know, he was, if you look at the championship standings after the event, he was still in second. So the way things finished up, Auriel was the winner from Panizzi. So, you know, Peugeot had a good decision there to put those two guys in for the manufacturer points, because they got the full haul, and it kind of kickstarted Peugeot's season in terms of the manufacturer's crown side of things. Mäkinen was third, so not a strong result for him. And, you know, as you said already, if he'd brought home more points from Sweden, he would have been, you know, almost uncatchable come the second half of the season, but it wasn't anyway.
It's an outrageous result, third in Catalonia in a car at the end of its life.
Yeah, no, it's as good now.
Obviously, French cars way ahead of their time as well. It's just class.
Yeah, obviously it was influenced by the Citroen retirement.
Yeah,
but look,
yeah.
So Likes came home fourth. Good result from him, and good to see him, you know, show a bit of pace.
Mm.
Signs in fifth, as we said, didn't Delacour in sixth. It's just interesting to note Ariel. You know, once you can ignore the sunglasses in the interview at the end, he makes a comment on the 206 being like a magic car. Basically, you just get in it and you win. That's kind of how we described it, which is a nice, I suppose, it's a simple way to put it, but a very
it was a nice change of tone as well.
Yeah,
on day three, his whole tone, the bit of porous is out, or he was like, oh, yeah, sure.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah,
we're happy again. We're rallying again.
Great. Yeah,
like someone that was invited to the party left the house and was, you know,
yeah.
Actually, on that another point on day three, looking at how hard Mackinnon was pushing, there's one piece
the onboard
there where he's. I mean, there's cutting and then there's just like.
Oh, I think I know this one. He's hopping from like cut to cut.
Yeah,
the car doesn't really touch the road in the middle of the two cuts or something. Yeah, it's crazy.
And it's big speed.
It's massive speed. The commitment is unbelievable to get
again,
that.
Again, just to note on the spectator stuff, like there's a shot of Delacour coming through with kind of a fourth gear left and right, and he's fairly hammering now. The car's moving a fair bit now, and there's someone lying down just after the cut on the right hander, like with a camera, like.
But you see that in Shakedown as well with Ariel nearly clattering.
A photographer, wasn't it? Yeah.
He was an older man as well.
Yeah.
But it's a shame, like, with events like that, and like you still see it today. Like you see, like Rally Mexico, Argentina, even in Spain and stuff. You see stuff popping up, and obviously the benefit of social media, it's up 2 seconds after it's happened. You see guys thinking they're class, sticking GoPros out with their hand out in the inside of corners, and it's just, I don't know what it is. It's like certain events just draw that certain level of stupidity.
Yeah, look,
and you never get rid of it.
Common sense is kind of missing in a lot of the cases here. But anyway, but this was Ariel's last win, wasn't it? I'm pretty sure.
Yeah.
So that was kind of the last high point in a long career. I think Pab, very quick guy in his day, doesn't, for me anyway, doesn't kind of stick in my kind of list of my all time. I don't know why. He just doesn't.
I'm the same. I agree with you. Like, even
maybe the Toyota thing could have turned me off him slightly. I just don't know. I don't know what it was. I think as well, I remember reading a quote in my early days, and you know yourself when you see these things when you're a kid, it tends to have a bit of an influence. That I can't remember who said it, but it was when he won the championship in 1994. That no one has ever driven so badly to clinch
the
title. It's something along those lines, isn't it?
He stumbled his way across the line to win that championship, and you've hit the nail on the head there. And that's no disrespect to him, but he did everything he could to lose it. And you look at Sainz, just got caught out on a left hand, on a right hander by a stump or something, and you know he just got stuck off the road. By rights, it was Sainz's championship.
Yeah. No, it is. Look, again,
VHS rallies will have the video footage up soon anyway, so we'll all get to look at it in depth, I'm sure.
Yeah. But anyway, look, fair play to the guy. It was still a good, a very good performance to be there, to, you know, in the position to take the win once the Citroens had gone. So, yeah, so as I said, just looking at the championship standings after this, Mackinnon 24 points, Sainz 18 points. So even though he hadn't had the best rally, he was still, you know, collecting the odd bit here and there. Ariel and Robin Pair tied then with 10 points apiece, and Delacour in nine points. Just going to his kind of consistent lower points scoring finishes so far. So fair play to him. And the Super 1600 class then, interesting to note that Duval had actually led for a time in the Puma. He'd run into trouble then. Loeb looks like it's hard enough to get information on it now, and there was very little footage of it. But it looks like Loeb got a puncture or something, lost a couple of minutes on the first day, and from there on he just lost his mind and was taking 10, 15, 20 seconds out of fellas there every stage. Backed after towards the end, I think he was two and a bit minutes clear by the end. So that was kind of set the tone for the Super 1600 championship there, or the junior championship there that year. He was to go on to dominate it. And we had Niall McShea was actually competing that year. A very, very quick guy.
Oh, yeah, we never touched on him, actually.
Yeah, Niall was a great driver. Still, I think he's still going. It's nice to doing a bit of rallying in China.
He's doing a bit in China. It's funny you mentioned that, McShay, because I was doing Donegal a couple of years ago, and I was very lucky to be in the company of a former Donegal rally winner, and we were talking, and he just turned around and he said to me, "There's a man walking around the service area, and half the people here don't even recognise who he is. Give him a car, he'd go out and he'd won that rally today." And 'twas Niall McShay just pushing a pram around the place and nobody paying any heed. Almost a forgotten man here of how much of a talent he was. Like, but you look at some of the names that he was up against there, and we discussed European rallying briefly before, and it's something we need to get into again. It's like a who's who of people that we've kind of seen, you know, over the last few years, like Larry Colls and Gian Domenico Basso and Cedric Gobert, Patrick Malgaud and Andre Delavia. You know, these were all quick guys, you know, and you're obviously seeing them in the very formative stages of their career. But like the JWRC at that stage was phenomenal.
Yeah. Do you know, every time you say someone says Cedric Robert, the only memory I have of Cedric Robert is in 2004 when he took the 307cc in Corsica, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And he crashed it. You know, that waterlogged. The bit of road was completely waterlogged. I remember he came along and just speared the car into the cliff. And he was the lad that he wears the I used to call him the underpants.
What?
The underpants joke. The what you call them? The balaclava. The ones that look like underpants.
Oh yeah, the one that goes up through.
The Schwartz used to wear them as well. They kind of they cover the nose, the bridge of the nose, as well as the.
They're hard to get now.
Sure, you would talk us out, Tommy, would you?
I still have contacts. Yeah, I
actually realized that I still have my gear packed away somewhere.
Probably, yeah, mine's gone moldy as well.
And no doubt it's probably out of date as well. No.
It's probably
2 minutes out of date as well.
I was just looking at a breakdown of the fastest drivers through the event in terms of, say, stage times. And for all his recurrent brake issues, I think it probably helped him in the end. Filip Ugalski set 8 fastest times on the out of the 17 stages. Pouras set 2, obviously Citroën being the dominant force there. Panizzi, 2 fastest times. Auriol with 4, with the only one breaking the French stranglehold being Mäkinen with 1 fastest time. But
yeah.
And Tommy.
There.
Tommy Mäkinen there, not Tommy Hayes.
No, Jesus. Forget Tommy Hayes as well.
Come on, Tommy Hayes, actually. Tommy with the worry.
Yeah, give him a bit of a boost there on this bank holiday Monday.
Yeah.
But yeah, that really displays, I suppose, the dominance the French teams had at the time, and the Michelins as well in tarmac. They were definitely the machines to have and the rubber to have. But anyway, so looking at the overall manufacturer standings, then Mitsubishi were still leading, pretty much solely due to Mäkinen. Ford were second. Peugeot jumped up to third, following the double, the 1-2 here by Auriol and Panizzi. Hyundai in fourth, Subaru in fifth. Jesus, that's
bad weekend.
Bad start to the season. I said there was probably questions.
Marco Martin was a DNF as well.
Yeah, there was questions being asked. That's back in Banbury, at this point, about what was going on. And obviously, look, they were heading into the rougher rallies of the season from here on in, which would generally tend to suit the Subarus and Fords a bit better than these kind of rallies. But anyway, and then Skoda bringing up the rear. But so that was it. A very, very interesting rally. Like most rallies of this era, lots and lots of variables. And you know, as we said, this is the first sign of how dominant Citroën were going to become. And look with hindsight. You could say this is nearly the beginning of the end for the Tory days. You know, the debut of these super, super quick cars that were going to just dominate everything for the next few years. But
isn't it fantastic though to be able to sit down and talk about rallies where we had 17 works entries? That's why we're able to talk about it, because there's so much to talk about, because you've 17 of these guys hammering tongues at it.
It's like looking at the Irish tarmac entry lists when the boom was here.
yeah, Two pages of WRC cars. It was a brilliant time, and as we said, we've plenty more to go. So, that's pretty much it for this week, guys. Unless you have anything else you want to add in before we go.
No, I can't think of anything. The only other point to make about Catalonia. Oh, my last point again. Me, the driver of the rally, Tommy Mäkinen. No business being in third or fourth place, no matter what way you look at it. He had no business being up that far. So.
Yeah,
my drive of the rally. The last one thing I'll make on Catalonia is for that year, it was probably the first clean event where everyone got a chance to just go flat out. Like you had Monte Carlo with Sweden, Portugal was a mess.
So then
Spain was like the first. I think it's why Catalonia is so nice is because, you know, if you look at the footage, the way the cars are set up, the driving, the onboards, it's just pure raw driving. There's nothing else happening. Do you know what I mean? Fire the cuts and the gravel getting pulled out. I think that's what makes it such a nice event to watch. And even going to spectate it, it's incredibly simple to spectate. I found it very easy.
Yeah, it's a really spectator friendly,
well run event.
And being based in Salou and stuff like that, you're done with the beach and there's plenty of stuff to do to team park and that. Yeah, it's a really, really good event. I personally, I'm not a fan of they've went to the split gravel and tarmac format for the last few years, and to me, in my head, Catalonia was always a traditional, you know, quick European tarmac event. Why they brought in this, they're not exactly great stages, the gravel stages they use, they're just dusty, they're a bit like Sardinia or something, they don't really have much in the way of character.
The only other argument for that is for anyone who's interested in the mechanical side of things and the engineering side of things with WRC cars, the year I was there in 2010, I was lucky enough to get into Solberg's. That's the year he was running his own team with the Zara. And through Ken Rees, who was a friend of my, a family friend to my aunt, we were lucky enough to get in and have a look around. He was running the team at the time, and I was watching them do the changeover of the car, and it's just class.
It's amazing when you see what the engineers and the technicians working on the cars can do within a confined period of time. It is, if you brought someone along who had no interest in rallying and tell them, you know, you see what has to be done to your car down to your local garage, come in and watch these guys.
Yeah, it's pretty impressive, especially in the time constraints that they have, as you said. But yeah, do you have anything else you want to add, Tommy?
No, not really. I'm suitably happy with how it's all gone.
Exhausted all your.
I've exhausted all my
facts. Cat facts.
I suppose the only thing.
I forgot a sponsor. This week's
Benson.
This week's guest sponsor is Didier Auriel's fucking sunglasses. Last time, no, I've enough of them now. I don't want to mention them anymore. The fucking. But anyway,
sponsored by Oriel's Angry Sunglasses.
You definitely, it's definitely worked because you're after getting about 20 pairs out of them anyway. So, you can keep them actually.
I have one thing actually I'd like to add. Okay. I spotted in one of the clips Dennis Giro Day proving that navigators are the wisest in dietary. In their dietary constraints, having a banana, so you know, verifying the choices I've made, you know. So
yeah, you're a banana enthusiast.
Banana enthusiast, yeah.
Good man. Anyway, that pretty much wraps us up for this week. Again, thanks for listening. So keep listening to us over the next while. We'll get through the remainder of the season. It's a cracking season.
We'll also put up the links to the footage underneath if you want as well.
Yeah, it's a good point actually. Yeah. So as we said, you know, we have all these full linked review shows on YouTube from the official WRC channel. So they're great watching, especially in these times when you might be looking for something to fill the void there between, you know, the trip to the fridge in the morning and the fucking
Tiger King is finished as well. So
fuck's sake.
Hey there, cool cats and kittens.
Oh, God. Fucking hell. Anyway, so next up, we've Argentina. So a trip across the Atlantic down to another classic event and a very interesting rally, as we will discover next week. But so that pretty much wraps us up. Keep looking out for us on social media. Like and subscribe. As we said, we'll work to get the podcast up on other platforms as soon as we can. So we'll let you know when we have that done. So for myself, Morris, and from the boys, thanks very much for listening again, and we'll talk to you next week. Goodbye.
Thanks guys. Happy Easter.